Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 17th of February. We talk about Haiti this hour of the program. We'll have two guests with us. One of our guests says that Haiti and the U.S. have had a torrid, twisted relationship for more than two centuries. It bears remembering that the Haitian Revolution against France began only 15 years after the U.S. declared its independence from the old world. The U.S. at various times has run the Central Haitian Bank, written the Haitian Constitution, installed puppet presidents, run the legislature, bribed officials with money and jobs, looked away and indeed encouraged corruption, and all in all treated Haiti and Haitians with a disrespect that verged on loathing. William Jennings Bryan, Secretary of State under Woodrow Wilson, said, imagine, and he used the N-word, speaking French. We have two guests with us this hour to look at the history of the first Black Republic. Our guests are Professor Lorraine Dubois, Department of Romance Studies, Professor of French Studies and History at Duke University, author of Avengers of the New World, The Story of the Haitian Revolution, The Forthcoming Soccer Empire, The World Cup, and The Future of France. He is continuing work on A General History of the Caribbean, and is co-author of Origins of the Black Atlantic. He earlier authored Slave Revolution in the Caribbean, 1789 to 1804, A Brief History with Comments. Later in the show, Amy Wilentz will join us, professor of English in the School of Humanities at the University of California, Irvine. She teaches in the Literary Journalism Program and is author of The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier. She started going to Haiti in 1986. We'll be welcoming your phone calls as we always do. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Dubois, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Why don't we start with the revolution, the Haitian Revolution against France, which this is remarkable. It began 15 years after the U.S. Revolution. Tell me about its origins and how they were successful.
Well, the first thing to know is that Saint-Domingue, which was the French colony that became Haiti, was probably the most successful colony in the Americas. This was a place that single-handedly produced more profits for France than all of the North American colonies did for the United States. For England when they were still colonies. So it was an incredibly important place economically, and that was all based on the labor of enslaved Africans. The French imported about 1 million Africans to Saint-Domingue over the 18th century. That's about a tenth of the full Atlantic slave trade. So it's a massive number.
Nice.
And out of that plantation economy, which was a very, very brutal economy that produced sugar and coffee, emerged this remarkable political movement that's really unique in world history, since it's the only really successful slave revolt in the sense that it actually abolished slavery in the society where it took place. So it's remarkable for that reason, and the course of it is extremely complicated, but the basic core of it is that there was this incredible political organization among the slaves themselves that managed to overthrow the plantation system, managed to ally with various forces outside of Haiti, and ultimately when they found they needed to go it on their own, created their own nation called Haiti.
And what did the world make of that? It must have caught everybody by surprise.
It was on one level very surprising to people, of course, because most people, even though on the one hand there had been slave revolts essentially from the very moment slavery began, there was always a sense that they couldn't really succeed, and indeed most of them were crushed or even exposed before they took place. That's the case in the United States. So I think what was surprising was maybe less that it happened or that it started than that it succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
It all was linked to a really important, crucial moment, of course, in world history, which is the broader Age of Revolution, and there are tight links between the French and Haitian revolutions, of course, that made in some ways the victory possible. And that's important to remember, that actually many people, certain radicals in the French Revolution, actually ultimately supported and embraced the slave revolution itself, which is something we sometimes forget. But there's a way in which, so there were people who were surprised by it. There were a certain number of people who were actually happy about it, who thought that in a sense this was a necessary development. Of course, many, many people, especially in the United States among slave owners, found it extremely dangerous and appalling. And Haiti, in some ways, has paid the price for that revolution and for its radical challenge to the broader world since then.
The other guest who will join us in a little while talks about the United States not recognizing Haiti for more than 20 years after the republic was established. Mm-hmm. She says even then the recognition was grudging at best, including blockades and diplomatic pressures of the most brutal kinds.
Mm-hmm. It's actually longer than that, because it only was during the Civil War that the U.S. actually recognized Haiti. France recognized Haiti in 1825 in return for Haiti paying a very large indemnity. So the Haitians actually had to pay money, which they had to take out loans to pay, in order for France to recognize their independence. The U.S., it was a Jefferson who pioneered the policy of diplomatic isolation. That was always a bit of a two-sided policy, since many American merchants actually went to Haiti and traded nonetheless, even though they weren't supposed to. So it was kind of willing to trade there, but refused to recognize this Black Republic. And certainly that's the beginning of a long and difficult relationship between the two countries.
And let's go forward over 100 years. They win independence, and then you talk about their being conquered and occupied by the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, they did. They were occupied in 1915 for 20 years, and it's a very long occupation. I mean, for the Haitians, it's essentially considered a colonial occupation, and indeed they refer to 1934, when the U.S. finally left, as their second independence. So this is a country, in a sense, that's had, that, as far as they see it, has had sort of two colonial experiences, both from France and the United States. And that occupation was extremely important in 20th century Haitian history, because it really set many things in motion that we would see play out over the whole 20th century. But it's sometimes forgotten, I think, because we have a kind of overly negative vision, I think, of Haitian history, that the 19th century, while certainly there were many issues of political instability, was actually one in which a lot of successful coffee economy took root. There were a lot of very successful regional economies. And while there was a lot of kind of changes at the level of the central government, there was actually quite a bit of stability in most of the country, and a kind of economic expansion. And a lot of merchants actually from Germany and North America and others would go to Haiti seeking profits and finding profits there. So in some ways, the turning point of the U.S. occupation is very important in terms of the economy of the country, too.
And what was the reason for the occupation? How did we justify that action?
Well, the immediate justification was that it was 1915, it was the beginning of World War One, and there was a significant group of German merchants in Haiti. Germans, for some time, had been rather important among the merchant community in Haiti. And many of them had intermarried with Haitians and so forth. So that was the stated justification. But, of course, it also took place just in a broader context. In the early 20th century, the United States was really moving into the Caribbean on all fronts, and Central America as well, after 1898 in Cuba and Puerto Rico. Of course, there was an occupation that started soon afterwards in the Dominican Republic. So in some ways, the occupation of Haiti was part of a larger kind of moment of U.S. empire in the Caribbean and Central America. But it did last longer than any place except for Puerto Rico, of course. But it did last longer than the others. And in some ways was a deeper and perhaps a more influential occupation in terms of the structures of the country itself.
Hmm. Tell me more about that. How so more influential?
One of the major kind of points of pride, in some ways, or a kind of core point of politics in Haiti from the beginning, was refusing. In the original constitution, the white foreigners could not come in and own land, and there was a very specific reason for that, which is that white foreigners were associated with slaveholding, with slavery, and since the mass of the population had freed themselves from a very brutal form of slavery, there was a sense that they needed to always control, you know, their own labor and their own land. So that sense of refusal is something that, of course, both some Haitian elites and foreign governments constantly critiqued, because many of them did want to come in and own land and kind of take advantage of the economic opportunities in Haiti. So one of the things that the U.S. did is they rewrote the Haitian constitution so that foreigners could own land. So they actually changed that kind of by force. I mean, obviously they had a group of Haitians who were working with them, and in fact there was very little military resistance when they first occupied the country. So this is not simply the U.S. imposing things, but actually in links with the Haitian elite were very important in doing this. Other sort of crucial things, and one of them really helps us understand in some ways the most recent events with the earthquake, is that what the United States did is they kind of accelerated a process of centralizing the whole economy of the country in Port-au-Prince. Before that, it had been really a set of regional economies, about 11, 12 different ports. They essentially shut down the smaller ports and made Port-au-Prince the main port. They believed that was kind of necessary for the economy of the country, created schools. They're actually the ones who built the National Palace and many of the government buildings that recently collapsed were built during the U.S. occupation. So there's a kind of centralization that also, of course, leads to Port-au-Prince becoming a larger and larger city in terms of population. So obviously that's had a big impact in the 20th century as well.
You asked the question, and I'd like to hear your answer. You talk about generations of dictators stripping the country of wealth and resources, lots of coups, corruption. Why is it that Haiti has not been able to develop some stable form of democratic self-rule over all these years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great question, and one we often, you know, consider, and one that Haitian intellectuals have long been thinking about as well. I think the key to the answer in part is the particularly difficult intersection between internal conflicts and external pressures, right? So that on the one hand, from its birth in 1804, Haiti had a very large population of people who had been brought from Africa, enslaved. At the time of independence, many of them were still people who had been born in Africa. In fact, the majority of the population in 1804 were African-born people. And what they constructed was a society really rooted in the refusal of that slavery experience, in the refusal of certain kinds of plantation labor, and a desire for their own autonomy, their own land, their own kind of dignity, the creation of families, and so forth. At the same time, the country had been totally constructed as a place for exporting sugar and coffee to the broader global market. So the question of how to create a kind of new order out of that has basically, in a sense, created a cycle of difficulties for Haiti. The leaders of the country often were outward focused and wanted to continue the plantation economy. The population itself largely wanted to, refuse that. So there was a very serious conflict within the country. At the same time, most foreign powers, really kind of have treated Haiti quite badly throughout its history, either isolating or refusing recognition, and then essentially trying to take advantage of it for a kind of profit and exploitation. And so that kind of cycle has, in some ways, the external pressures have enforced some of the worst impulses and gestures of local leaders, and in some ways local leaders, who might have been otherwise not in power have been held up by their links with the outside world. So it's been a particularly bad and poisonous combination of both internal and external forces.
Which leader of Haiti do you think has been the most important, the most inspirational, the person who has been able to get things done?
Well, there's been a series. I mean, it's interesting because all of the great leaders, I think, are, in some ways are kind of ambiguous, right? So starting with Toussaint Louverture, who was a great hero and really constructed a new order and is a phenomenal figure in terms of anti-slavery revolution and so forth, but also was very invested in reconstructing the plantation system and so is seen in some ways as somebody who also, was forced people back onto the plantations. Dessalines, who is the person who declared independence, in some ways really set the groundwork, the foundation for much of Haitian nationalism, but also, had a complicated relationship with many of the people. In the 19th century, one leader, Boyer, held power for 20 years. It was a kind of moment of stability in many ways, but also a somewhat repressive government was eventually overthrown. And in the 20th century, there's been a series of, I think, very promising leaders, but in each case, it seems like, I mean, obviously there was the Duvalier dictatorship, which is not what I'm talking about, but right. That was a kind of, but before the Duvalier dictatorship, and then, of course, afterwards with Aristide and Préval, there have been these kind of, very strong political movements that have sought to create something else, to create an alternative with really massive support from civil society. And yet again and again, they've kind of faltered. And in some ways, it's not a mystery exactly, but it's something we really have to think really carefully about why that's happened. And something that obviously there's a great deal of debate about as well.
Spend some time on Aristide. You talk about his biography and story, such a dramatic, important one, a priest in a poor neighborhood, a symbol of so much hope of resistance against the military regimes. How was he treated by the international community, and what do Haitians think of him now?
Well, it's a dramatic story and one that, is at once kind of, in some ways, very painful because it's a story of somebody who, and Aimé Willens has written just beautifully about his origins and sort of the early years. This is someone who came out of the liberation theology background, a kind of preacher, a very charismatic figure that many people, really, really admired, who kind of helps in the crucial 1980s after the end of Duvalier create a kind of alternative to the Duvalier state and the military leaders who continue in some ways the Duvalier state after he's gone. So after his election in 1990, a very popular election, and he was then overthrown by a military coup and then spent many years in exile in the United States. before he was then returned, of course, by Bill Clinton with a military intervention in 94. And sometimes people make a distinction between sort of the first phase and the second phase of his career. He certainly returned in some ways with many constraints placed upon him by the international community about what he could do. And he served from 94 to 96, then Préval, who's now president, served as president because he was told he couldn't complete his whole term, even though he had been out of the country for most of it. And then he returned to power in 2000. The disappointment that many people have in Aristide is that many people did feel like he ultimately began to sort of do some of the bad habits that other leaders had in terms of repression of his opponents and so forth. So there's a lot of division about Aristide. I mean, many people in Haiti are still very supportive of him, while others, you know, many are also disappointed with what happened and would like to go on to other leaders from here. So he's still a source of a great deal of division within Haiti itself.
We're going to introduce our next guest in just a moment and welcome your phone calls. Amy Lentz will be joining us momentarily, professor of English, School of Humanities at University of California, Irvine. She started going to Haiti in 1986. She is, she's quite a writer. She's the former Jerusalem correspondent of The New Yorker. She's a longtime contributing editor of The Nation, author of Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier. She edited and translated The Parish of the Poor, a collection of the writings of Haitian president and political leader Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Professor Dubois made reference to that just a moment ago. And we'll be welcoming your phone calls. We're looking at the history of Haiti this hour and from what we can learn from the past in terms of going forward after their horrendous earthquake. So we'll be with you momentarily, and we'll meet Amy momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will start taking your phone calls in just a moment. We do want to introduce Professor Amy Lentz and ask her to give us a few comments about some important issues, and then we will take your calls. Professor Lentz, thank you so much for being with us. There we go. Professor Lentz, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Great. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And I assume the two of you know each other. You certainly know of each other. Professor Dubois is also on with us.
Yes, I know.
Okay.
Yes, of course.
Great. And we'll start taking calls in a moment. Amy, I want to ask you, you have written extensively about Haiti. You talk about Paul Farmer, who we've interviewed many times, the doctor in international humanitarian, done incredible work in Haiti, that he has, you write, that the media has perpetuated a series of peculiarly potent myths about Haiti and Haitians, and it may influence the way Haitians feel about themselves. What are those myths?
Well, I mean, most recently it's been an attack on Haiti for its traditional African religions that are still practiced, known more commonly and vulgarly as voodoo. And, you know, Rush Limbaugh said that the Haitians had made a pact with the devil early in their history, and that's why the earthquake happened to them. Or was it Pat Robertson?
It was Pat Robertson,
yeah,
right.
Pat Robertson. So,
you know, but that's not a myth that, although he said it more forcefully and in a sort of more potent way than what you would normally see in the media, the mainstream media, I don't consider him mainstream, there's still that feeling. That's one of the myths. I mean, all of it comes from this kind of genteel racism that assumes that both Africa and African-based states cannot succeed. And so one of the myths is voodoo. The other is they're incapable of governing themselves. And, of course, Haiti gives you plenty of reason to think people are incapable of governing themselves down there. They govern a certain part of themselves, but not the whole, you know, not in a proper legalistic sense. So there are a lot of myths, and then the Haitians do play into those myths and keep them alive. But I would say the worst and most persistent is the myth that somehow voodoo is an evil religion.
Right. Mm. You talk about, and let me hear both of you, starting with you, Amy, globalization, that Haitians long for the days before globalization. They didn't have to compete with cheaper produce from abroad. The countryside was a little bit more self-sufficient as it was when you started going there in 1986. What's been the impact of globalization?
Well, what's happened to the Haitian marketplace is that cheaper subsidized products from the U.S. have come into it and therefore have really cut off the incentives for cultivators to bring their produce to market and to even properly cultivate. So it sort of impoverishes agriculture and the countryside. And in turn, because the people then in the countryside are poorer and are having more difficulty surviving, they end up coming to the city and overpopulating the city in the desperate hope that they'll find work there. And then they do find work there in the, you know, offshore industries, but it's a very brutalizing and low-paid kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's crucial because it obviously, well, it tells us a lot about why Port-au-Prince is the way it is. And it's been quite devastating, in especially from the 1980s on, because of IMF requests and so forth, the kind of local production of rice declined and so forth. I think there's, all, you know, in a sense, Haiti is the product of globalization from the very beginning, since it's part of this Atlantic slave trade. And in a sense, the sort of culture is about resisting that. In some ways, we're trying to find an alternative to it in many ways. So I think that's crucial. And I do want to second Amy's points about voodoo. I mean, I think if there's one thing we can really try to do is to try to get people to have a much more complicated view of Haitian religion and realize how crucial it is and will be in kind of the reconstruction effort as well.
Mm-hmm. And that would be a gigantic step forward, may I say, politically in the history of the West. If the white world could come to realize that voodoo is not a cannibalizing, deviant religion, but really resembles so closely the Greek myths we all study, mm-hmm. I think that would be a giant step forward for understanding Africa and understanding Haiti and understanding Latin America.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's welcome in some phone calls. We have a number of people who would like to speak. Alan from Madison, our first caller. Hi, Alan. Alan, you want to turn your radio down? Hello, Alan. All right, I don't know where Alan is, but I know what his question is, and I wanted to ask this anyhow. Why is it, you look at the island and people ask, why is it that the Dominican Republic has flourished in a way that Haiti has not?
I think Professor Dubois should answer that one.
Okay. I mean, it's an old, you know, it's a common question, and it's again, unfortunately, you have to go back pretty far back in history to answer it. I mean, Dominican Republic was really, it was never really a large-scale slave colony. It has a completely different history. It was a kind of support colony to the larger Latin American empire in the Americas. So it is a very different economy, has a whole different sort of structure of population and history. So it's, while it's kind of a little easy right now to sort of see the distinction, it's also true that the histories are intimately connected, and of course the U.S. occupied both of them, both the Trujillo and the Duvalier dictatorships, you know, in some ways emerged out of the occupation or the influences of the occupation, so there's plenty that ties them together as well, and you know, while there's been a lot of tension between the countries, there's also some historical connections, and Dominican organizations have been quite incredible in the recent round of efforts, humanitarian efforts too, so it's a kind of complicated story there.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to add one thing to that.
Sure.
Though. What people
mm-hmm.
like to do with that difference, what commentators from outside like to do, like, what is wrong with Haiti? Look at Haiti. It's deforested. It's a,
yes.
It's a wreck. And the Dominican Republic is fabulous. And I always mm-hmm. say, okay, remove from your blinders the color issue. Pretend Haitians are white and Dominicans are white. And then do what Professor Dubois has just done. Look mm-hmm. at the history.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right, right.
Yeah. We need to do a little bit updated history, too. We talked about the revolution. We talked about the U.S. occupation. But you've written about these, both of you, actually. But let's go to you on this, Amy. What happened under Bill Clinton? What happened under the first Bush presidency, the second Bush presidency in terms of U.S. relations? We've been tinkering with that country, it seems like, forever.
Well, it's a test tube nation, you know, in so many ways. As I don't know if you've discussed this, but apparently there are more non-governmental organizations operating in Haiti than in any other country in the world per capita, something like 10,000.
Yep.
And yet we see still a society and a country in the process of failure. So I don't think we can say that the outside interventions have been very helpful. But in terms of the U.S. relationship with Haiti, I always find it, you know, fascinating that the U.S. continues to be so interested in Haiti, and continued in times really when there wasn't the kind of threat of mass migration that there is possibly now and has been in recent decades. We just have a psychological relationship to the first black republic, I think, that is tormented and kind of torrid almost. And mm-hmm. during the more recent years, what you've really seen is Republicans and sort of outside of the Republican Party, sort of cowboy Republicans operating in Haiti trying to influence politics, and that's why you got the two asters of Aristide under the Bush regimes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean, it's exciting to be on with Amy because her book is a fabulous, account of some of these early, of the 1980s period. It was one of the first books I read about Haiti when I was in college. And I think it's really crucial to kind of understand that the United States has always been involved. So rather, what happens is most people are not aware of that involvement most of the time until there's a crisis like the recent one. And then suddenly it's like, oh my God, there's this country, Haiti, what's going on? And instead, it's as if they've been doing all this on their own, right? But the kind of constant involvement. My friend Jean Casimir, who's a former ambassador, I'm teaching a class with him, jokes that, in Haiti you need a new index of underdevelopment, which is experts per inhabitant, and by that measure Haiti has this, it's true that there's this massive presence of external organizations. And that's, so what it forces us to really start thinking about is like, well, what are these NGOs doing? What is the broader model that we're bringing to bear on Haiti? Why is this, it's not for lack of attempts in some ways, but I think in some ways there's some deeper problems that just Haiti challenges us to think about as well.
I wanted to add one thing to that. There's a joke in Haiti, and I assume it's in Latin America as well. The question is, why are there no coup d'etats in the United States? And the answer is, no U.S. embassy.
Interesting. You both have this theme of what is needed is international cooperation. Amy, you write, we need a coalition of the willing and a refusal to go forward without the inclusion of President Preval's government at every level. Mm-hmm. That brings to mind a couple of questions about his leadership, if he's been too quiet about all of this, and have there been any movements to come up with, rebuilding the government? Is there up 10 questions. Is there international cooperation and is his government being included, whoever's alive?
Well, I'm not quite up to date on all the ins and outs of this, but I would say that at the very beginning, I was kind of freaked by Preval's passivity because you felt at that moment that the Haitian people needed a leader and a Churchill who would get up and say, Haitian, Haïtien, rise to the occasion, let me help you, let me lead you. But on reconsideration, I can sort of understand a quieter leadership as long as the leadership is actually as long as he's actually doing the work to start rebuilding Haiti and making the kinds of connections to the international community that is certainly going to be present there for a while to show that he is the president of Haiti. So therefore, I'm a little bit worried about this idea of a UN, I don't know what it's called, a consulship or something like that, that would include the president, but it would be like a junta, an international junta of three, I don't know, a UN person, a U.S. person, and the president of Haiti. I think the president of Haiti is the president of Haiti, and he has to be the leader who is in charge of rebuilding and redevelopment.
Mm-hmm.
Just to second that, I think that one of the things I think we need to constantly remind people of is actually how incredibly organized Haitians were in response to the earthquake, which is not the sense you not always get when you look. I mean, obviously, it's an incredibly difficult situation, but without sort of state helping in that way, local organizations, community and neighborhoods and so forth mobilized in kind of incredible ways to respond. And that's important. And I think in some ways, while maybe Preval didn't sort of stand out as a leader, there were lots of leaders who were sort of taking roles. And I sort of doubt that if we had the same situation in the United States, we would respond the same way, actually. But also, I think it's crucial for this, for the sovereignty of Haiti to be respected, for the state to be respected, and for us to think about how they can be assisted in that way. But what's complicated in Haiti, I think, is that in some ways the history of the state itself means that people have very conflicted and complicated relationships to the state, right? So there are so many different ways in which Haitian society is organized, in some ways independently from and even in opposition to the state, that it's not a simple question to figure out exactly how the state should function. While, of course, the basic goals of delivering, basic infrastructure and education and so forth have to be pursued.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I want to go back
but it's hard to just see this kind of Western European future. I mean, people talk about the Marshall Plan, but it's hard to see how you take a country like Haiti that for so long the people have had to be organized on their own because the state has failed them completely, how you're going to just take it and sort of march it into a new dawn. I just kind of roll my eyes because it is such an exceptional country, especially in this hemisphere. You know, how that's going to work is questionable. But as Professor Dubois says, we did see incredible organization. I mean, basically, the Haitians have rebuilt Port-au-Prince. It doesn't look like rebuilding to us because all they have to rebuild it with thus far are sticks and sheets.
Yes.
But everybody has his own little place already.
Mm-hmm.
So that's,
absolutely.
I think that has been an incredible thing.
Yeah, it has when you give it that thought. That's true. Let's go back to phone calls. 800-486-8655. Art from Milwaukee. Hello.
Hi. I'm interested in any observations you have of the relationship between Haiti and Cuba. I mean, first of all, you've got, since the 1959 revolution in Cuba, some 50 years of embargo and hostility from the U.S. and something to have it on the world community, and of course Haiti from 1804 until the Civil War under Lincoln, 1860 before we recognized them, because they were, you know, supposedly a danger, their ideas might spread. And to the present, where you've now got hundreds of Haitian doctors who are trained for free in Cuba working with, I even see those people from, doctors from Mali who are coming to work with Haiti, all part of a Cuban trained doctor contingent of over 1,000 people, some from the U.S. as well. And then you've got, going forward, you know, the idea of the privatizing the economy using Haiti as an experiment, and of course Cuba has a different model in terms of prioritizing public services. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts might be on that.
Well, I have one historical observation to make, which I think a lot of the fear of Aristide and resentment of Aristide on the part of certain entities in the U.S. as well as in Haiti was the fear that he was another Fidel. Mm. And that somehow he would revolutionize Haiti and change the structures of power and empower the masses. So I think that fueled a lot of the work that was done against him. And but he also did have relations with Cuba and start bringing Cuban doctors and Cuban NGOs into Haiti. So it was an interesting play of politics in the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm. Wait, do you think that's true, that there was worry he was going to be another Castro, Professor Dubois?
Well, yeah, I think that plays. I mean, I think that kind of, since 1959, that has always played a role in U.S. politics in the Caribbean. And in fact, it's one of the main reasons. I mean, the U.S. heavily supported the Duvalier regimes for precisely that reason. Right? Duvalier cast the crucial vote in expelling Cuba and the OAS and so forth. So, you know, the Cold War politics continue to haunt us in the Caribbean as they do elsewhere in the world. But at the same time, there has been incredible work done by Cuban doctors in Haiti and indeed in a lot of parts of Haiti. I mean, the doctors are going to find our Cubans. So that's been crucial. What's interesting, I mean, the Caribbean is so fascinating for its kind of contrast, right? Because Haiti, I think, is, people talk about privatizing Haiti, but I can't really, Haiti is about the most privatized society I can think of anywhere. I mean, there's almost everything is delivered through some kind of private services, right?
I used to say that under Reagan, that Haiti was the perfect example of the kind of country he was talking about.
Exactly, right. So it's sort of, I mean, so when people talk about, it's kind of almost like there's not really anything left to privatize. So I think in some ways the opposite needs to be taken into consideration. But and then, of course, Cuba, a completely different society, and both of them, you know, to think about them in relation to each other is extremely important, because the question in both cases is, how do you have sovereignty? How do you have dignity? How do you deliver, you know, real change to people? And both of them, you know, are sort of together, they help us think about how both what's possible and what's, and then the limits placed by outsiders on what's possible in the Caribbean.
Kenneth from Oshkosh. Hi. Hello, Kenneth.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
about 35 years ago, I'm concerned with the things that the Haitians and South Americans are doing for themselves. About 35 years ago, they came across a geography book, pointed out that the education part of the OAS was considering every South American and Caribbean nation to put out the text themselves to reduce the cost of it, so that it went like from $5 a book down to like 50 cents a book. The other thing was, who had created a food supplement, get all the necessary amino acids, proteins, vitamins, minerals, etc., that could be produced by the South American Caribbean nations themselves. Whatever happened to these type of initiatives from the nations themselves?
Thanks, Kenneth.
I mean, you know, I think Haitians have basically produced their own food for 200 years. You know, they have the capacity, and when that has been eliminated, it's precisely because of some of the external interventions. I mean, there's no limit in some ways to the resources and the abilities that people have to grow a variety of crops and so forth. They had a thriving rice economy and so forth. So I think the resources are really there for that, and what we have to look to is the kind of larger forces that have, in fact, undermined that as well. I will say, in terms of the university system, I mean, you know, Haiti has an incredible intellectual tradition, has incredible universities. They've been extremely, really devastated by the last earthquake. The École Normale Supérieure collapsed with the whole freshman class essentially in it, killed and so forth. So there are a lot of efforts underway, but there's certainly all kinds of ways in which we can work with the university communities to help what they're doing, which they've been doing for a long time. And that, again, those are things that I think sometimes we don't see much about in the United States, is just the institutions are there, the people are there, there's incredible work being done. And obviously, you know, there's going to be an enormous amount of work to reconstruct and to help the reconstruction in those areas.
The will of the people, you write about, Professor Willens, talking about the capacity of this people for survival and for greatness in the worst of conditions has been demonstrated for more than two centuries.
Mm. Yes. well, there I'm talking mostly about how they survived slavery,
mm-hmm.
and rose to revolution, and I would call that greatness. So that was the first thing I meant when I wrote that, and the other thing I meant was that they then continued to survive international pariah status and down into this generation. I mean, everything has been arrayed against them for years and years and years, in spite of all those NGOs practicing their arts in Haiti, and yet they survive, and they, in some senses, thrive in conditions of extreme neediness.
Yeah.
So I think we can say that they have a capacity for greatness.
Right. Let's go back to those NGOs. That's been swirling around in my brain since you brought up that number, and my jaw was dropping. What in the world are all those NGOs doing?
They're planting trees.
What are they doing?
Planting trees.
Planting trees.
Teaching kids sex education. I'm just trying to think offhand of what I've seen them mm-hmm. doing.
I mean, is it partly that since the state, since many basic services, right, are not really provided by the state, sort of issues of health care and education and, yes, tree reforestation, there's a lot of environmental projects and so forth. So there's lots of different projects going on, both in neighborhoods within Port-au-Prince and then throughout the country. I mean, it really is. If you're in a traffic jam in Port-au-Prince, it's going to be mostly NGO cars, right?
Sometimes, oh my goodness,
what cars?
There's an incredible presence of people, and you know, again, I think a lot of people are doing really excellent work with the best of intentions and so forth. So it's not. There's just this kind of structural, but there's a way in which that may be incompatible with trying to have a strong Haitian state, right? In some ways, there's a cycle that goes on that's created for even before the earthquake, just for a very complicated political matrix. And people talk about the Republic of NGOs, the UN, the Haitian state, and then other groups kind of all sharing power in Haiti. And it makes for a very complicated political situation for sure.
We're going to welcome more phone calls. Our phone number lines are open for you right now as we look at a history of Haiti. I've been wanting to do this show ever since the earthquake hit, but of course our focus was on what was needed there in a humanitarian fashion, and now we're looking at the very deep and complicated history of Haiti this hour of the program, U.S. relationship, which hasn't been very splendid since Haiti became a republic, and their remarkable history in overthrowing a slave system. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Here's our email, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guests this hour are Professor Lorraine Dubois, Professor of French Studies and History at Duke University, author of a number of books, including Avengers of the New World, The Story of the Haitian Revolution, Professor Amy Willens, author of The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, and contributor to Time's Earthquake Haiti Tragedy and Hope, former Jerusalem correspondent of The New Yorker, and she's written for The Nation for a long time. She's at the University of California at Irvine. Back to phone calls, we go to Charles from Appleton next. Hi, Charles.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My question is how does sugar, sugarcane play into the whole picture? I know that when the slaves won their freedom from the French, sugarcane was the main export. What has happened since then?
Well, basically, the sugarcane was the main export under the colony, and the revolution really, I mean, one of the key goals of the revolution was literally to destroy the sugar economy, which had been, you know, which had been very brutal for the slaves who were working under it, and they literally smashed the kind of sugar production, the infrastructure as well. Although Toussaint Louverture tried to reconstruct the sugar economy, he was never really able to, and nobody has ever been really able to rebuild sugar, although the U.S. corporations have tried, and many other organizations have tried. They've done it in the Dominican Republic. But other crops like coffee and many other crops, rice and so forth, have succeeded in Haiti. But there's a kind of baseline sense that sugar will never come back to Haiti. I mean, I think people refuse it because it's associated with a particularly brutal form of slavery.
They refuse it, but they do it in the Dominican Republic. And I've been on those farms, and it is like slavery. I mean, when you see how Haitians live on the sugar plantations in the Dominican Republic, just across the border from Haiti, it's very shocking. Mm-hmm. They live in slave quarters, basically.
Really?
Yep, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And actually, in Florida, too, you will find a lot of Haitians working in sugarcane, Florida, in extremely, very, very hard conditions. So that's absolutely the case. Yep.
We have a new president in the United States. Will that alter the relationship with Haiti? Can you give us an assessment of the Obama administration's relationship with the country?
I think the Obama administration had an immediate response that was very heartening to Haitians. I know that Haitians in general, they just love President Obama. They think they just can't believe that he's president of the United States for racial reasons. And he has a Haitian very high up on his staff, the head of his head political officer, I believe, is Patrick Gaspard.
Mm-hmm.
So Haitians love that too. They feel that they have an in at the White House. And then there are the Clinton duo, which are now associated with President Obama, and Haitians have like a complicated feeling about President Clinton, but basically he put back President Aristide, so they have a sort of warm feeling for him too.
Mm.
But that said, and I'm pleased with the initial response, I just want to see a continuing intelligent back and forth between the Obama administration and the Haitian government so that we don't get this kind of paternalistic relationship going.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, I had some friends who were in Haiti right after the election, and they said they were just sort of followed by crowds of people, you know, crowds of kids chanting Obama, and people were, you know, delighted about the victory and so forth. So there's that. And I do think the key is really that intelligent connection. Obviously, there are, you know, about 2 million Haitian Americans at this point, so there's a huge Haitian community. I think that has actually changed a little bit the tenor of the coverage of this event. You know, people feel like this is a little closer to home. And what we really need to see is follow through, and as Amy said, an intelligent, you know, connected response with the Haitian government.
Mm-hmm. What does it do? I've never lived through an earthquake or a national, most people haven't, a national disaster of this kind of dimension. What does it do to a country, both of you, do you think, to have so many of your family members die and your houses gone and the kind of incredible devastation there is? Does it just sort of take the spirit out of you? I find that hard to take into my soul.
I think first, I mean, I was down there right after the earthquake, and I think the first response is to survive. So that's why you saw so many blank faces on the TV coverage, and I saw this too in person. You know, everyone remarked no one was crying, and that was considered, aren't Haitians weird? But I think they were in shock, and they had to just run about their business and build a new shelter, et cetera. So there was that moment of not realizing. Now there's the moment of being able to look around a little and see what's really happened.
Mm.
Also, you have to remember that they were in it instead of watching it. So they couldn't quite grasp the enormity of what had happened to the capital immediately. They knew what had happened to their neighborhood. And that by now they know what's happened to the whole capital. But they didn't know at first what had happened because they were just living through it. They didn't have their TVs on.
Mm-hmm.
So that
was
different too. But I think, going forward, it's going to be very, very difficult. And it's especially difficult for Haitians to let go when they haven't been able to properly bury their dead.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's an enormously crucial issue. I had a student who's an American student who was down there and was actually underneath, you know, underneath a building for a couple of hours and was saved by a friend with a little hammer who dug her out. And she wrote a piece about this for Salon. Her name is Laura Wagner. But it's been, you know, it's, I think at first people survive, and then there's incredible weight, you know, of lost friends, and you know, little by little, in some ways, it comes to overtake people. And obviously, there's going to be an enormous, you know, there's enormous trauma in some ways that's going to take a lot of time to work through, and just to see an entire city. I mean, this is a, you know, it's a remarkable city with, you know, its key monuments gone, a whole world, and essentially just kind of vanished in an instant. You know, it's just, I think the enormity of it is hard to take. I mean, this is really one of the, you know, massive natural disasters that we've seen in our lifetime. Ever. I think it's hard
and I
to
think
compare.
The appropriate comparison is Hiroshima or Nagasaki.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
That's quite a dramatic comparison. Steve in Madison, hi.
Yeah, thank you. This 1 hour doesn't barely scratch the surface, so if it's possible to get these two back on the same topic in the immediate future, that would be appreciated. But for the time that they're here, I would ask if and when Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, calls to ask for their advice, what would they say? What would they say?
All right.
Go on, Laura. She's more likely to call you.
I don't know about that. But, you know, I think it's I find the Clintons really intriguing and interesting because they obviously have a long connection with Haiti. And they are people who kind of are familiar with the country on some level, right? They've been going for a long time. And I think they have the right impulse, which is that you really have to know. The problem in some ways is that, you know, what does the broader community have to offer? Obviously, we can offer reconstruction and assistance, which is vital. In terms of the economic models, right, to bring small manufacturing back to Haiti, I'm not sure. I think I would love to see like more imagination about what we can do to find a way to think through the future of Haiti and its economic and political future from within Haiti, you know, from within the many resources, intellectual and you know, social that are in the country. I mean, obviously people have said this before and it's not an easy task, but there's a way in which I think Haiti is going, you know, we need something a little different than what we've had for the past couple of decades as a response. And so maybe this is an opportunity to really start thinking hard about what could really work for Haiti, what could really help with Haitians, you know, fulfill their aspirations on the terms in which they want to fulfill them, and be a little cautious about bringing models or certainties that have been circulating for a long time to a country where they've been applied over and over again without bearing much result.
What's sad about that, though, is that so many people died in this earthquake who would have been valuable in going forward. And I
Absolutely.
Think that's very shocking to the intellectual classes and the student class and all the professors who died. Huge immediate brain drain happened in those few minutes.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
We go to Anne from Madison. Hi, Anne.
Hi, thanks for having this program. I just had a comment about small island countries and the way they're treated by the huge countries. They're about 20 to 100 miles from, look what the United States has considered Cuba, a real thumb in its eye, you know, just something that needs to be taken over. And to a certain degree, that's the way we've treated all the Caribbean countries. Taiwan is, you know, seems to be a threat to mainland China. And even Ireland was, in a way, that kind of threat to England. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think this is operating all over the world. I would recommend that people see the video Life and Debt, DEBT. It's about Jamaica. But Jamaica is just across the way, and it is about how globalization, which is privatization by all these multinational companies, has destroyed Jamaica's own economy. And, of course, Jamaica's in a lot better condition than Haiti has ever been. And third, I was going to ask pretty much the same question other people have asked, but with the recent Supreme Court decision that gives transnational corporations even just a full steam ahead signal, and the way corporations are controlling countries now, even great big ones like us, rather than the other way around, what can people in the United States do to see that this privatization model doesn't continue? And one final...
I need to hold you there because we're almost out of time. Professor Willens, would you take that? We have about 30 seconds.
Well, I just think that we have to continue to advocate for democracy and for the right of people to determine their own future, which is what Haiti is all about. And we have to hope that the Haitians can survive in some innovative and creative way, the way they always have, the onslaught of the modern era.
Mm, very good. Thank you both so much. You were superb guests, and I've learned so much this hour. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our guest this hour, Professor Amy Willens. She's author of The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, contributor to Time's Earthquake Haiti, Tragedy and Hope. And she worked for The New Yorker, is an editor at The Nation, teaches in the literary journalism program at the University of California at Irvine. Professor Laurent Dubois, professor of French studies and history at Duke University, author of Avengers of the New World, The Story of the Haitian Revolution. Thanks to Connor O'Brien, our intern from Marquette University, for producing this program with assistance from Rhonda Fanning. And thanks to Connor as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Thank you, everybody, for all of your calls. We have news coming up, and we'll return with more Wednesday conversation here on the Ideas Network.